morning. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue, Thursday, May 16th. I'm changing the order of the agenda just to make sure we get our business done this morning. We're going to begin with a work session. The public hearing will be second. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2699A.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2699A deals with something that's called the Brownfield Property Tax Exemption. So currently in statute, a county or city may adopt an ordinance exempting brownfields or providing special assessment for that property for up to 10 initial years and 5 additional years. But it doesn't currently allow stacking with other property tax incentives. And so this bill would allow a property owner to receive the property tax exemption for something like land held for low-income housing or low-income housing, I assume, once it was cleaned up, but then also during the cleanup period receive property tax exemption for the brownfield. But it could not go below zero. So the property tax at most would fall to zero. The revenue impact would be negative because we're now allowing a property tax exemption that isn't currently allowed, which is the intersection of those multiple property tax exemptions. But the magnitude is unknown. Partly that's because this brownfield property tax exemption hasn't widely been utilized yet. It's just starting to be adopted in Marion County and Multnomah County and would essentially allow a sort of longer stream of property tax exemption. The fiscal impact is indeterminate, mostly because it is a local option and would be dealt at the local level.
Thank you, and I'm particularly interested in something that you just mentioned last. It's a local option. It's not a mandate, it's an option, and there's a sentence in the staff measure summary that explains that a city, county, or port would be required to specify in ordinance or resolution how multiple property tax benefits would be applied. So there's going to be another set of eyes on this. It's not just an automatic, everybody gets everything.
Yes, Chair, that's right. And when they, when the city or county local ordinance, or city or county decides to adopt the local ordinance in the bill and in the statute, it's required that they describe the plan of action, how those would be stacked.
Thank you.
Chair Nathanson, I move House Bill 2699A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Marsh moves House Bill 2699A to the floor with due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Motion passes. The carrier will be Representative McCune. There is no other business related to this bill. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2699A, opening the public hearing on House Bill 2390.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, House Bill 2390, as introduced, requires the state treasurer to study and make recommendations related to the depositories of public funds. There is a -2 amendment that was posted on OLIS last night. It replaces the bill and deals with some issues that the state treasurer is facing when depositing and holding public funds. I believe there are representatives from the Treasury signed up to testify to talk about that amendment specifically, as well as people that were a part of a work group that took place on these issues.
Thank you. First, I'd like to hear from Cora Parker and Brian Gonzalez. And by the way, I should let you know that many or all of us need to leave by 8:30, but I think there should be ample time for everyone to provide testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cora Parker. I'm the Director of Finance with the Oregon State Treasurer's Office. We're here today to talk to you about House Bill 2390. As staff from the Legislative Revenue Office explained, what you originally had in front of you was essentially a placeholder bill that mimicked the language from House Bill 2779, excuse me, from the 2017 session. What was included in the amendments presented before you are actually the work that outlined the recommendations of the work group that was actually held during the interim, as well as some cleanup or housekeeping issues that were identified as we went through making those recommendations in Chapter 295. I will say at the outset, just because of the time that we have in front of us and potentially some limitations, the bulk of what you find in the fairly massive set of amendments in front of you, the bulk of what you see there is actually the housekeeping-related changes. And really, Section 29 and Section 30 are the sections that outline the recommendations of the work group and would address the issues that that work group studied. So that's what the front part of my testimony will talk about today. And then certainly we can come back to those housekeeping changes that are intended really to clean up and make the statute clearer, but do not have any policy-related elements embedded in them. And we worked closely with the members of the work group to make sure that as we pushed those changes, particularly in those other sections, that there weren't any unintended policy changes, and was comfortable. And I think the other testimony that you'll hear today will embrace that. And certainly, if not, we're willing to continue that conversation in a way that addresses it. So again, to set the stage, Oregon's public funds laws were first enacted in the 1930s following the failure of financial institutions during the Great Depression. The law's requirements were structured to protect public funds against loss due to financial institution failure or insolvency. And public funds, importantly, are defined as those funds that a public official has custody or controls by virtue of office. And that can include controls by contract. It does not have to mean has physical custody. And that's important for the conversation that we're having today and the issues that we're addressing. And importantly, the law applies broadly across all government entities in Oregon. It is not just applicable to the state and its agencies. Again, it protects public funds by providing that they may be deposited in any financial institution within Oregon up to either the amount covered by federal insurance or, when exceeding those limits, deposited at financial institutions that participate in what we refer to as the Public Funds Collateralization Program. Essentially, that is the program that is created by the provisions of Chapter 295. Under the program, qualified depositories, both bank depositories and credit union depositories, are required to pledge collateral against the funds that they hold for public officials. And that collateral provides protection against the potential loss of those funds in the event of a failure by that financial institution. It includes a shared liability structure, which spreads the risk across the variety of participants in each of those two pools. And again, the liability is unique and individual to the bank depository program and then separately to the credit union depository program. As you might imagine, with these laws originally being passed in the 1930s, much has changed in the world since that time. Public bodies, of course, themselves are driven by a number of financial and resource constraints and are looking to ways to be efficient with their approach to serving their constituents. And in addition to that, a variety of technology changes have occurred that allow them to partner with a variety of third-party entities who can help them in providing those services. When those partnerships, however, include payment-related components, a public body under existing law must comply with the provisions of Chapter 295. That means that their third-party vendor must essentially agree to hold those funds in partnership with a qualified public funds depository. If they bank with an institution that does not fall under the provisions of the chapter, then they are not in compliance with public funds law in Oregon. And that has increasingly become a problem over the years as our state agencies and potentially our local governments look to partner with what is otherwise a relationship that would make a lot of sense for the state of Oregon. At times, the agencies, or again, other public bodies, are able to identify third-party vendors who are willing to change their processes and come into compliance with the provisions of Chapter 295. But many of those third-party vendors are large national corporations who are not willing to make significant changes to their business processes or banking relationships in order to address what to them is a very discreet and, you know, very small portion of what their business would otherwise be. And I'm going to provide a few examples of what that looks like. So I'll provide three. One was an example of where vendors were able to successfully change their approach. I'll then outline where a vendor was not able or willing to change an approach and the impact it had on an agency. And then another where there was not an ability to change, and that actually led to the work group and the study that we've brought for you this morning. So you might recall that State Fair used to be part of a state agency here underneath Parks. And there were a variety of potential compliance issues that arose at times with regard to sale of concert tickets. Ultimately, the third-party vendors who worked with State Parks at the time were willing and able to change their business practices. So Wilco and Ticket Force were the third-party vendors that they were working with, and they essentially were able to change business practices and come into compliance. They agreed to hold the funds in the separate accounts and in qualified public funds depositories in Oregon. And so there's a situation where relatively local firms or firms that were willing to make changes and come into compliance with the chapter. Another example where ultimately compliance was achieved, but it was because we had to fail one vendor and ultimately move to another. And that relates to Lottery. Lottery made changes several years ago related to its internal payroll functions, breaking from use of the state's system in some ways to achieve some efficiencies and actually make better choices for their constituents. The first proposed vendor, though, was not able or willing to amend its flow of processing and to come into compliance. And so ultimately, Lottery was not able to engage with that third-party vendor. They had to identify a second vendor, and that vendor was able to come into compliance, and they're proceeding with them today. Finally, examples where we simply were not able to bring a third-party vendor into compliance and ultimately not able to identify a solution. One example includes universities. Again, while universities are no longer directly a part of the state in the manner that they were when they sat as state agencies, they do still have a direct relationship with the state treasurer's office with regard to banking some of their funds. And the example I'm providing you is actually from before the changes were made and when they were under, more directly under the control of Chapter 295 in the way state agencies are. Those universities had solutions with regards to the collection of tuition from foreign students. At least two companies were not willing or able to change their business practices, including not being able to come into compliance with 295. Ultimately, that meant that there were no solutions that were identified, and we continued with inefficient business practices, which includes the collection of large amounts of cash that were brought by those students, or foreign checks, which present their own difficulties. And finally, OLCC and their approval of Walmart as one of the retailers in a limited market within Oregon. Walmart was approved as a limited retailer within the state, but they were not able to come into compliance with the flow of funds that all of the other liquor agents within Oregon followed. Legislative changes were ultimately made that allowed OLCC to have an exemption to Chapter 295 and some specific parameters that outlined and governed that exemption. They were not the only...
Ms. Parker,
yes.
I'm going to interrupt you for just a moment. It's very helpful for us to understand the background and what has led to the work group and the recommendation that you will be describing to us, but we have just barely 10 minutes left and four other people to testify. I'm envisioning I may even be in a position of needing to carry this over if we can't complete it. So I would like to interrupt your testimony for a moment. There's someone here who I know is not in the building every day, like some of the others of you are. Doug Goh, would you please come up? I want to make sure that we can hear from you. I've taken the time to be with us this morning. I'd like to be sure we hear your testimony while you're here.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I appreciate the opportunity. I'm Doug Goh, and I have the pleasure of serving as the chair of the Oregon Short-Term Fund Board. And also am a municipal bond lawyer with Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe. The role of the Oregon Short-Term Fund, as you know, it invests both on behalf of the state as well as local governments about, at any one time, $19 to $21 billion in short-term funds. And the reason, and we so appreciate on behalf of the board, the committee reviewing this bill this morning, the provisions of the bill that I'm here to testify relate to the investment of Oregon local government funds. One of the issues that has come as we review the investment policies of Oregon's local governments is that this is a very technical amendment. And it's to clarify that the ratings when a particular bond, for example, a local government is deciding whether to invest in a bond, the statute has said that you could invest in bonds or particular investments, say, in the AA category or the A category. The purpose of the legislation today is to clarify when the legislature said the A category or the AA category, that included all gradations of investments within that category. So, for example, the statute now, as amended, clarifies that, for example, if you're in the A minus category, that is an eligible investment, and these amendments have the unanimous support of the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission, as well as the Oregon Short-Term Fund Board. Would be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have, and I so appreciate your consideration and support. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions for Mr. Goh? Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Chair.
Go ahead.
Sure. If it pleases the chair, because you do have written testimony in front of you, I can be very brief in wrapping up essentially the recommendations, which are again outlined in the written testimony and in the report that the work group put in front of you. Essentially, sections 29 and sections 30 of the amendment broaden the existing provisions of the chapter and allow for the state treasurer's office on behalf of agencies and for individual local governments on behalf of themselves through their own governing bodies or public officials to expand the ways in which we can protect public funds. Chapter 295 uses the financial institution model and collateralization of funds through that approach. Essentially, the recommendation here is to acknowledge that there are other ways to protect those public funds and to allow for an approach that continues to fully collateralize those funds, but do it through partnerships with the vendors themselves. And essentially, this would allow for policymaking by the state treasurer's office and open up opportunities such as surety bonding, an approach that we're referring to as vendor collateralization, and also letters of credit. Again, as I identified at the outset, the remainder of the changes within the chapter are largely housekeeping. So, for example, the use of the word qualified is inserted in front of public depositories. That's a term that we've used for a number of years but has not actually been spelled out in statute. And there are a number of other clarifying mechanisms like that. Again, we worked very closely to make sure that none of those were intended or perceived as policy changes within the statute. So that's the summary, and I appreciate your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Gonzalez. I have nothing further to add.
Mr. Gonzalez is here to answer any questions about the bill itself and the changes. If you
have any questions, yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a question, is this a common practice in other states?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Reschke, while the specific parameters outlined in other states differ, the shared liability structure and the collateralization approach is fairly common.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we'll hear from Wendy Johnson and Rob Beauvais. And if you need more time, we will reschedule, but I can't anticipate how much time you might want.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Ovett, Legal Counsel Association of Oregon County, is here today representing the Oregon Association of County Treasurers and Finance Officers. The Dash 2's good bill should pass. I don't have any more to say.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson, here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. I participated on the interim work group. It's a complex area of law. The intent is to make sure that public funds, of course, are protected. It was mentioned pretty quickly, the public official is personally liable if there's a loss of funds. And that's where it gets personal for our cities, because if there are many vendors who don't have branches in Oregon, and so there's not another choice. And so this bill allows cities to work out a deal with those vendors, but we fear that some of those vendors just won't do an alternative. As the examples were provided by Ms. Parker, some companies won't comply, and that will mean larger costs to local governments because there isn't an alternative that is cost effective. And so we're pleased with how this provides some flexibility. I think we'll wanna see how this plays out with those vendors to see if there are some exceptions that should be just made because there isn't an alternative, and yet there isn't the risk to public funds if they bank somewhere else, for example, or it's a different vendor. We would have liked more flexibility, frankly, but this does provide some flexibility. And of course, lastly, we do really appreciate Section 52, the part that Mr. Goh talked about, because most of our local governments do invest in that fund and needed that clarity. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Good. Any questions? Thank you both.
Thank you.
Is there anything that LRO would like to add in response to information that's been presented?
I don't think so. It was helpful to get the background, the additional information. I read the work group report, but I think the written testimony is something that will be helpful to our office in the future.
Good. There's nothing else to cover on this particular bill. Don't everyone jump up and leave. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2390. And if the committee is agreeable, we could suspend the rules to allow Representative Hernandez to vote on House Bill 2699. How do you vote?
Aye.
Thank you. There's no other business before us today. We're adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.